Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist, 3rd of October 2018. We've just done an article on, this is episode probably 5, and we've just done an article about looking at the DNA sequences. Not a lot of new information in there, however, this is the DNA origins of ourselves, that us Europeans at least are a combination of Neanderthal and Homo sapiens. We're sort of crossbreed, and some Asian people, or say particular people, Polynesian people, are a crossbreed between Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, and Denisonians. I think that's correct. It's going across. I was going back to check it. Yes, Asians are all in all parts. Yeah, as I look over there, there's actual. Looking at the diagram that they said there, and it doesn't seem to really support what they say in the article. This article is The Call of Rewilding. So rewilding would be, say, an urban environment which you introduce wild animals back into. Now, Graham Lawton reports, the idea of letting nature reclaim lands has swept the West, but does it work? It was a bitchy postcard, this quote, bitchy postcard of how English countryside was meant to look. Isabella Tree tells me. Is a tree. It was a working farm. We had green fields, manicured hedgerows, ditches, land that was constantly active with maize, barley, rye, grass cattle. We didn't realize it at the time, but it was virtually a biological desert. Now it looks much more like Africa. She was talking about her home, the Kep Estate in West Sussex. 17 years ago, she and her husband, Charlie Burnell, stopped trying to coax a living out of the heavy soil. Today, the 1,400-hectare estate is the closest thing in southern England to the primeval landscape, a mosaic of water meadows, thorny scrub, shallow groves, and grazing lawn roamed by cattle, ponies, pigs, and deer. The colliding of different habitats has been a rocket fuel for biodiversity, says Tree. Kemp, K-N-E-P-P, is an experimental in rewilding, a movement that has swept the Western world in recent years and takes the different forms of different places. But a simple and compelling concept drives it, that nature runs things and can right the wrongs we have done to the Earth's wildlife. Habitats will restore themselves and biodiversity will bounce back along with the vital services that the ecosystem provides, such as pollination and water purification. Yet, even as experiments like KNEEP take off, researchers are voicing concerns about how effective rewilding truly is. Meanwhile, the world has embarked on a huge but largely undirected rewilding project as vast tracts of once productive agricultural land are abandoned. This is bringing unexpected answers to what really happens when you let nature run its course. The original concept of rewilding was attributed to ecologist Michael Sully at the University of California, Santa Cruz in 1998. He published an essay outlining a new approach for conservation in North America. He advocated creating wildlife corridors between existing reserves, linking them up to create a wilderness large enough to support active carnivores such as wolves, bears, and even introduce ones such as lions. Hopefully not lions in your, surely you mean it's pumas up in America. Like mountain lions. The idea was underpinned by cutting-edge ecology, and specifically the concept of tropic cascades. This holds that ecosystems are principally shaped by the feeding behavior of large herbivores and carnivores, the apex consumers, largely absent from today's human-dominated ecosystems. Put them back in, so the logic went, and the ecosystem would automatically be restored to a healthier, more biodiverse state. When Sewell proposed rewilding, the tropic cascade hypothesis was already being tested on the ground in Yellowstone National Park. The creation of the park in 1865 did not stop rangers from shooting wolves, the natural apex predators. By the 1920s, they had been totally eradicated with a huge knock-on effects. The elk population exploded, causing bison to decline owing to competition for food, and beaver numbers to crash as elk overbrowse the trees next to the river. Coyotes also boomed and gobbled up the pockhorn antelopes. In 1995, after a long campaign, wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone. Almost immediately, changes went to reverse. Tropic cascades were elevated to an iron rule of ecology. Ecologists John Turber and James Est describes them in a 2010 book on the subject as a, quote, universal property of ecosystems functioning, a law of nature as essential as fundamental to ecology as natural selection is to evolution. So trophic change. One of the many big and charismatic rewilding projects that have now been set up, most essentially attempts to restore trophic cascades by introducing large animals, with the hope they will force the ecosystem back to real estate. Now, the oldest and most famous of the Pleistocene Park, a 160 square kilometer natural reserve just north of the Arctic Circle in Siberia. Since 1996, scientists have been attempting to recreate the mammoth steppe that circled the northern hemisphere at the latitudes and at the end of the Pleistocene epoch 22,000 years ago. Back then, most terrestrial ecosystems were dominated by huge herbivore mammals such as mammoths, rhinos, mastodons, and ground sloths. I don't understand what the difference between a mammoth and a mastodon is, of course. They ate, trampled, dug vast amounts of vegetation, kept grassland free from trees, and recycled nutrients through their copious dung. When they were wiped out by human hunters, the ecosystem was pushed into a radically different state, less open, less fertile, less biodiverse. With the mega herbivores gone, predators such as lions, bears, wolves called the shots. Keeping populations smaller, populations of smaller herbivores in check through their own trophic cascade until the predators were themselves almost hunted to extinction. And these waves of losses happened across the world. Some 100 genera of megafauna died out, precipitating a wave of secondary extinctions. The result was an overall simplification of food webs, a process called trophic downgrading. According to a review paper published in Science by Itrit and Soli, Trouble and others in 2011, the loss of apex consumers is arguably humankind's most pervasive influence on the natural world. But how do you make a mammoth steep without mammoths that have long since bitten the dust? This touches on one of the most troublesome questions of rewilding biology. Rewilding implies a return to a previous state, yet restoring things to the way they were before humans is often not an option. The original animal may be extinct, or reintroduction of predators may provoke opposition from people worried about their own safety and those of their livestock. The Pleistocene Park, the ecological role in this page here. It's actually indeed two pages. Just sort of feel that, sorry mate. We'll get on. Germany, wow, this is areas wilder than Europe. For some reason, no data for Norway. I tell you what, you forget Norway's got so much land. You always think Norway's just on the very edge, just up there. Of mammoths, it's taken by herds of animals, including musk oxen, elk, yaks, Yakut horses, European bison, reindeer, predated upon existing populations of bears and wolves. According to Park Manager Nikita Zimov of the North East Scientific Station at Yakulta, that is bringing results. I would not call it a steep ecosystem at the moment, but we're going there, he says. It's not an easy task to shift one ecosystem to another. The park is the most biodiverse and most productive than the tundra it has replaced, he says. The knock-on benefits of the ecosystem surface is special carbon sequestration, pooing, I suppose. In North America, however, Searle's original vision has been slowly to materialize. An organization called Wildlands Network is gradually piecing together four separate wildernesses across Canada, the US, and Mexico. But progress is glacially slow. Searle now, in his 80s, is philosophical. Conservation is always an uphill battle, he says. There are so many elements in society that don't want any sort of restoration to occur because it interferes with the economic activity. End quote. In parts of Europe, though, all ideas are alive and well, largely thanks to the fact that large predators are already making a comeback. This means trophic cascades can be restored simply by the reintroduction of herbivores, a cannon fodder approach that is key to one of Europe's grandest rewilding projects. In the Rhodope Mountains straddling Bulgaria and Greece border. The idea here is to create corridors between the area's existing national parks to build a wilderness covering 2,500 square kilometers and restore the deer population to provide food for the wolves and bears already living in the mountains. It's good to, deer in Australia are an absolute pest. People just shoot them just mercilessly. Poor old Bambi. Del Salvero, an NGO Rewilding Europe, which oversees the project, is calls this trophic change restoration. It's not about looking back, it's about looking forward, he says. It's impossible to try to restore ecosystems to how they were, so we'll end up with something new, but we'll still want them to be more natural, more wildlife, more natural. He's repeated himself there. Doesn't matter for Europe. Actually, I was just really trying to remember some of my Norwegian processes where nature can manage itself. The expectation that deer and wolves will eventually recover to the natural population densities and black vultures will follow thanks to the carcasses left after wolf kills. With plenty of deer to eat, the wolves should also be less likely to attack livestock, so human wildlife conflict will be reduced. Quote, we are now seeing results with much higher density of deer impacting the wolves and vultures, says Savira. Full trophic restoration is, of this kind requires vast areas of predators to roam. Wolf pack typically needs 200 square kilometres in landscapes regulated by human activity, such as those in Europe. This is rarely an option. The answer can be to go halfway, restoring the herbivores but leaving out the carnivores. This is the approach taken up by KNEP in England's densely populated south and another well-known rewilding project. Utrechtse Vlakte in the Netherlands, this 56 square kilometre site east of Amsterdam and was reclaimed from the sea in 1967. An earmark for industrial development. Nothing happened, it gradually ran wild, becoming an important bird habitat. To keep this habitat from being swallowed by forests, in the early 1980s, its managers introduced cattle and horses to intensify the grazing. Red deer were added in 1992. Sounds like a sort of pie. The activities have helped create an ecosystem that ecologist Franz Vera, the site's manager, has claimed is analogous to the Pleistocene Europe. but the lack of carnivores to devour herbivores and provide natural break on the amount they consume means that it must be culled or given cosmetic food from time to time. Yeah, well, you feed them, then cull them if you just want to have a good meal, I suppose. Similarly, kip and some grazers are culled periodically and their meat sold, or well, there you go. Meaning humans are effectively acting as apex predators. That raises questions on whether such projects are true spiritual rewilding, but the concept of trophic cascades has itself recently come into criticism. Why do we assume that all ecosystems in the world are controlled from the top? Asked David Noguz. It's going to be trick-or-treat here, Tommy's here. In the University of Copenhagen, Denmark. This is one of the main scientific assumptions in rewilding, but there are many exceptions. He points to recently published research digging deep into the causes of ecological change at the end of the Pleistocene at five sites in Britain and Ireland. This concluded the climate was much more influential than the presence and absence of mega herbivores. Even Yellowstone, the quintessential example, the strength of trophic cascade effect has been questioned. Quote, it's safe to say that generally wolves reduce prey populations and that varying effect on vegetation and the prey they feed on, says David Lee Mitch of the North Prairie Wildlife Research Center of North Dakota. Quote, but below the trophic level, effects are more diluted and variable. End quote. And the increase in beaver numbers following the reintroduction of wolves, for example, probably had less to do with the end of the elk overgrazing and more to do with separate program to bring back beavers that took place soon after the wolves returned. Yes, probably. Another skeptic is Richard Collett at the Chinese Academy of Science Center for Integrative Conservatism in Yuan. He says that rewilding programs have got ahead of the science and there is an urgent need for long-term experiments. Quote, I am a general supporter of rewilding, he says. The romantic aspect appeals to anyone involved in ecology who sees everything going downhill from the past 50 years. But the lack of science is a major issue. Despite these concerns, rewilding is becoming a feature of conservation biology. Okay, most of it's happening entirely by accident. However, as huge swathes of farmlands are taken out of productive use. According to some estimates, within the European Union alone, about 300,000 square kilometres of farmland will be abandoned between 2000 and 2023, the area the size of Italy. Abandonment is also happening in Americas, Australia and some developing countries driven by low productivity, agricultural intensification and demographic change. Much abandoned land is marginal areas such as uplands. Once deserted, most is simply left on its own devices. Sorry. This is known as passive rewilding. It may not get pulses racing into the same way as releasing charismatic animals into a wilderness landscape. But in terms of land area, it is much more significant. That is the future of rewilding, says Collett. If you look at estimates of land likely to be abandoned, they are as big as the current protected areas and much bigger than the classic ecological restoration projects. That is a huge opportunity to revive biodiversity. This is the Stanford tests. There's a whole lot of those tests which are really dubious now. But it needs to be supported by good science. Quote, We need to know what happens when we just abandon land, says Colette. There seems some indications, there are some indications in 2014, a team led by Cecil Kvetsor of Stockholm Resilience Center in Sweden reviewed 276 sites on the effect of farmland abandonment. Surprisingly, the researchers found that quite some areas saw an increase in biodiversity, most did not, especially in Europe. That is because traditionally farm landscapes often create a wildlife range for habitats for wildlife. When human intervention stops, the biodiverse cultural landscapes disappear. A classic example is the Portugal's Coa Valley, which is one of the highest levels of land abandonment in Europe. The area was once used for grazing cattle and running pigs and produced wild foods such as mushrooms. This low-intensity agriculture captured a mosaic of habitats with high levels of biodiversity supported by endangered Iberian leeks and Spanish imperial eagles. But as the abandonment progresses, much of the Sierra Valley will become choked with dense scrub and forest and is under constant threat to wildlife. Similar stories in Japan. Their traditional terraced rice paddies are rapidly being deserted as the population dwindles and the people switch from rice to wheat. Wow. In 1961, half the land was once turned over to rice, amounting to 2,700 square kilometres, has been left to run wild. Another 1,600 square kilometres is expected to follow the next decade. Management of the paddies through flooding and mowing maintains the diversity of habitats and wildlife. When it ceases, the field becomes choked with vines and invasive bamboos. Over the past 15 years, Japanese ecologists have documented a steady decline in insects, birds, and amphibians and plants. Well, I was thinking that it would choke once, but then it wouldn't be just choke, that's the end of it. It would choke, stir itself out, and then get moving. I think it would be exactly dip. For some of these areas, a certain amount of active rewilding may be the answer, as Kemp, with species surveys show that these activities of herbivores has driven an increase in biodiversity. The Coa Valley is one of rewilding Europe's flagship projects. It plans to reopen the landscape by introducing horses and cattle. But given the scale of the land abandonment, such active well-planned intervention will remain a rare luxury. Find out more about the effects of passive rewilding. I visited the nature reserve in the uplands of northern England, where experiments have been going on for more than 6 years. Moor House Upper Teesdale National Nature Reserve was established in 1952, a vast area of bleak, soggy moorland crisscrossed by streams and scarred by the remains of 19th century lead mines. It represents exactly the sort of hard scrabble land where passive rewilding is mostly happening. Quote, there's a large portion of the land that is marginal for agriculture. It's likely to be this marginal land that goes out of production, says my host to the site, Rob Rose, of the Centre of Ecology and Hydrology in Lancaster. Starting in 1953, scientists began fencing off areas to see what happens when they are left ungrazed by sheep. In a total of 8 areas were enclosed have now been undisturbed for 50 years or more. This experiment has been particularly relevant to the rewilding debate in Northern Europe. Roses tell me, for example, a common view of the British uplands promoted by the writer and activist George Monblot and others holds that Lake District National Park, a little to the west of Moor House, is a biodiversity desert destroyed by overgrazing and that the answer is to take sheep off the land. We trek over the enclosed plot called Bog Hill. Sheep have been excluded from this mossy mire for 65 years. But to the naked eye, the land inside and outside the enclosure are identical. Detailed studies of the soil and vegetation confirm that very little has changed. The story is repeated in all plots. A lot of landscapes are very resilient to change, says Rose. This suggests that bringing back nature by doing nothing can take an awful long time, and taking the cheaper way from areas such as Lake District will do little or nothing for biodiversity. Perhaps the reverse of Kep, at Kep, they kept one plot out of bounds to big animals and did not see the same explosive rebound in nature, he says. Without heavy-hitting herbivores, the land takes ages to remove, he says. In many places, passive rewilding looks like an oxymoron. Just leaving the land to go its own way may actually lead to further reduction of biodiversity and less increase. For that reason, Collett advocates active intervention, at least at the beginning. Quote, we have to work out something cheap to do on abandoned land that enhances conservation. Aspect will turn out to be some selective reintroductions, he says. How are you, Quaff?
Yes.
If we work it out, abandoned farmlands represents our best chance yet to substantial rewilding large area. Despite the challenge ahead, trees lost the mystics, she says, Kip is the start of something bigger. Something not dissimilar to Searle's vision of drawing up existing reserves to create vast areas. Quote, farmers now have at least marginal land like ours, are considering joining forces and becoming farm clusters, pulling up their borders and doing projects like this, says Tree. We need more space for nature. Rewilding can provide the weaving link, the isolated spots, and connect up bigger landscapes. We're very excited. Yeah, my overall thing is that just in your overall gardening, if you let your garden be pretty wild, you get all birds and all things coming in. Philip Zimbardo, in 1971, he's now 85 and still gives talks. Let's see if it's a picture of him. He's a pretty dapper. Good looker, 1971. Look at him. Gee, the 1970s. That was such a wank. So this is an article, no? This is the Stanford experiments. These experiments are under so much criticism. I wonder if this actually comes out. So, the experiments are flawed. Philip Zimbardo's Stanford prison experiment was one of the most seductive pieces of drama in the history of psychology, despite its flaws. Oh, Philip explores what makes it so compelling. This is, you know, where you can actually force people to do evil. And I think it's rather interesting. I think stupid, stupid people are evil. The evil inside us all. In a darkened auditorium in September 2008, I sat in the audience awaiting to start the presentation entitled The Psychology of Evil by social psychologist Philip Zimbardo. Suddenly, the doors at the back of the theatre burst open, lights flashed, and Satana's song Evil Ways blared from speakers. A man with slick black hair and devilishly pointed beard danced up the aisle towards the stage, snapping his fingers in time with the music. Zimbardo's flamboyant entrance was startling, given the nature of his talk. I shouldn't have been surprised. Zimbardo's knack for performance is one of the reasons his Stanford prison experience is one of the most famous psychological studies in the 20th century, alongside research into obedience carried out by his high school classmate Stanley Milgram. And now that Milgram's experiment is very flawed because people knew in advance it had to be a prank. Ensuring, and so it's pretty interesting that there's now a standard screening test in front before you actually do psychological testing to see whether the test is, whether you're blingering or cheating or whatever it is. Assuming conventional academic reporting, Zimbardo's first account of the experiment was a sensational piece that appeared in a supplement of the New York Times, showcasing his skill as a storyteller. The article kicked off by detailing how, one Sunday morning in Palo Alto, California, 1971, police swooped on the homes of 9 young men. They had bundled into squad cars and taken to police station, charged, then blindfolded and transferred to Stanford County Jail, where they met their guards. The jail was actually a setup in the basement of the building of Stanford University. Prisoners were one half of a group of volunteers, the other half being assigned as a lawyer's guard. With what Zimbardo described as a gradual Kafkaesque metamorphosis of good into evil, the seemingly well-adjusted, but a lot of these experiments only work once and only work in an era. So a lot of really actual scientific experiments, like neurology experiments, only worked in the 70s. So this is like the frozen in the dopamine effects. So it'd be hard to work out what's going on. Young men became increasingly brutal as guards. They repeatedly stripped their prisoners naked, hooded them, chained them, denied them food or bedding privileges, put them in solitary confinement, and made them clean toilet bowls with their bare hands and by the way. Over time, these amusements took a sexual turn, such as having prisoners stimulate sodomy on each other. The prisoners, humiliated and victimized, suffered such emotional stress that Zimbardo, playing the role of an all-powerful prison superintendent, terminated the two-week experiments after just 6 days. The experience made the key players famous, not the least because Zimbardo captured the whole experiment on film and in now familiar photos. The images showed aggressive-looking guards in tinted aviator shades, clutching police batons, and cowed, shackled prisoners sitting in a line with bags over their head. The experiment led Zimbardo to conclude that normal people could be transformed into sadistic tyrants or passive slaves, not because of any inherent personality flaws, but through finding themselves in a dehumanizing environment. Context was king. And suddenly, so was Zimbardo. Overnight, he became a go-to expert on prison reform, and over the following decade, he appeared at a series of congressional hearings and advisory panel on the U.S. prison system. The Stanford experiment might have started as a psychological exploration of incarceration, but Zimbardo and countless media commentators since have reached for it to illuminate the ever-widening range of behaviours, police brutality, corporate fraud, domestic abuse, genocide. Every invocation of the experiment was cemented in the public imagination. The experiment had become enshrined in a psychological curriculum for its simple and compelling conclusion, that corrupt environments can turn good people evil, and of course, it has made a leap into popular culture, inspiring documentaries, books, and dramatization. The most recent film was based on was the 2015 Stanford Prison Experiment, for which Zimbardo was the consultant. Better credibility. Zimbardo was elected the president of the American Psychological Association in 2002, and in 2012 received the American Psychological Foundation Scholar Medal for Lifetime Achievement. Despite Zimbardo's recognition and career honors, as the experiment being called in all the textbooks, academic psychology is ambivalent about it. Not surprising, given the experiment is a scientific credibility to take a battering. On the one hand, with his high profile and media know-how, Zimbardo has done much to promote social psychology. On the other, his experiments, ethics, methodology, and conclusions have long troubled colleagues, it told me. First published criticism in 1973 attacked the ethics of the study and questioned whether the apparent degradation of young men was justified given the experiment's unsurprising result. By 1975, the methodology of the experiment came under fire. Several claims that the results support the view that behaviour is determined by circumstances, not personality, have also been robustly challenged by a growing number of researchers since then. After all, critics argued the guards' behaviour was hardly spontaneous. They knew they were expected to behave like tyrants and were encouraged to do so. And, by Zimbardo's own admission, two-thirds of them did not act sadistically, undermining his claim that the situation had an overpowering influence on the actions. How did the study so far become a famous first? the powerful idea of evil lurks inside all of us, waiting for the right or wrong circumstances to be called forth. The experiment itself may be shocking, but the way it echoes the archetypal stories of stubbornness makes it hard to shake sin off. So I don't know where they're coming from. Then there's Zimbardo himself, a compelling narrator who inserts himself in front and center of the drama. In that first published account, Zimbardo admitted to a growing sense of unease over his role as architect of the experiment of such cruelty. His epiphany helped long by a visit from his then girlfriend. He was appalled at his behavior, that he too had been corrupted by power, and was prompted him to call the experiment off. The acceptance of blame both disarms the critics of the ethics of the experiment and suggests that we can trust him to give an unvarnished account for research. There are echoes of biblical conversion stories. Zimbardo's subsequent involvement in prison reform is more, and more recently the project to train ordinary people to become heroes, are forms of atonement. I want to be remembered not as the Dr. Evil Zimbardo is telling me, but as Dr. Good.
Yes, hon?
Public performances, TV appearances, and TED Talks have an evangelical flavor. Let's face it, good versus evil sells, and it circumvents the hassle of trying to understand the subtleties of human psychology. Zimbardo also has a talent for reframing the lessons of the Stanford experiment to capture the prevailing zeitgeist. In 2004, a study made headlines when it emerged the American military police had abused, tortured prisoners inside Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. The public debate about U.S. soldiers could be behave so appallingly raised comparison with the experiment. Rekindling is pretty amazing. Zimbardo's career as government-appointed expert. In a Boston Globe editorial, he wrote, quote, "The terrible things my guards at Stanford did to their prisoners are comparable to the horrors inflicted on the Iraqi detainees. In reality, the terrifying, degrading acts of physical, psychological, and sexual abuse meted out at Abu Ghraib were way beyond anything experienced in Zimbardo's prisoners." But this fresh attention sparked a more critical examination by journalists who bypassed Zimbardo and sought out the people who took part. Cracks soon appeared in Zimbardo's tightly controlled narratives. Interviews, researchers had, and the participants, an alternative story emerged. In 2004, in the article of Los Angeles Times, journalist Alan Zermirbo reported the prisoner Douglas Corp was disgusted with the experiment and Zimbardo's exploitation of it. Both Corpy and Dave Elshman, who was often depicted as one of the more sadistic guards, spoke of a staged experiment and they had relieved in order to fulfill their role as paid participants. That undermined Zimbardo's insistence that participants unquestionably accepted the reality of the dramatic situation. In 2011, Zimbardo admitted that the study's limitation, it wasn't a formal experiment. My colleagues probably never thought much of it, he told an interviewer. In a high-profile blog post in 2013, textbook author Peter Gray decried the inclusion of the experiment in teaching psychology and later called it an embarrassment to the field. April this year, French author Thibault Letixier published a book, Histoire de Monage, A History of a Lie. The text here compared the archival records of Zimbardo's published accounts, listened to audio recordings and video footage of the experiment that had been edited out of a public presentation and interviewed research sites, former guards and prisoners. He concluded that Zimbardo's claims were overblown and his findings hollow. This is similar to Milgram's one. In the subsequent article on the Medium website, journalist Belen Blum confronted Zimbardo with the contradictions the text here had uncovered. Zimbardo pointed out to the fame of the experiment as his defense. He later published a rebuttal on his website, infuriating critics of his research by dismissing them as bloggers and labelling their findings as differences in interpretation. Only time will tell if the recent revelations will diminish the experiment in the public imagination. If social psychology can be said to have attained the status of religious teaching, then Zimbardo's has done one of the field's best-known preachers. And like a good preacher, Zimbardo represents the story of these experiments as a timeless parable. Quote, famous studies like Milgram's obedience to authority, Michel's marshmallows test, and Stanford's prison experiments raise moral issues and offer lessons about psychology of temptation. I've got with the marshmallow test, I forgot what that was. I do remember the marshmallow test. It's where people are left there and do they take the marshmallow and explain it. Zimbardo tells me, quote, think about the Lord's Prayer. What is the key line? Let us not temptation, but deliver us from evil. There are temptations all around us, and who gives in and who resists is a fundamental thing about human nature, and what is all these experiences explore, and that gives them a great public appeal. In his 2007 bestseller, The Lucifer Effect, Zimbardo appealed to the readers to look inwards. Could we, like God's favourite angel, Lucifer, ever be led into temptation to do the unthinkable to others? I think Voltaire is very interesting. Voltaire's interest, he's going to have to believe absurdities here. He promised readers a journey that will take them to the genocide of Rwanda, mass suicide murders, people's temples followed the jungles of Guyana, Milo massacre in Vietnam, and the horrors of Nazi concentration camps, the torture by military and civilian police around the world, the sexual abuse of parishioners by Catholic priests. He adds that one thread lying the atrocities together comes from the Stanford prison experiment.
Yes, son? Yeah, I'll be there in a sec.
Through his story of descent into basement hell, the suffering epiphany, the ascent, the transformation and redemption, Zimbardo offers a powerful message of hope about the human nature. We all have the potential to be saints rather than sinners. It's seductive to think that the fight between good and evil, we can be all winners through the redemptive power of psychological knowledge. Shame that, as far as Stanford Prison Experiment is concerned, it's far more showbiz than science.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.